Welcome to the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road and Coach Jonathan Lee. And today we are going to talk about why your performance drops towards the end of races. I know it probably seems like, well, duh, you're racing for longer, but we're going to get into it. Yeah. Big tired. It happens. But we're going to get into it in more detail than that. It's going to be great. We're going to analyze a race and go through training and how it leads up to that. So then hopefully next time you're doing a long ride, big race, something like that, you can be armed with great information that can help you. We're also going to talk about if there are any downsides to heat adaptation and how heat adaptation works. We're also going to do some hot takes. It's going to be a good episode. We'll save the hot takes for the end. And if you're joining us right now and you're on YouTube, we appreciate it so much. And give us a thumbs up on this video. You can hit thumbs up. Subscribe to our YouTube channel. Getting close to 100,000. We got to cross that mark. That's a big milestone for us. It'd be fantastic. And the more people that find this podcast, the more people sign up for Trainer Road, the more great features we can bring to all of you. So I want to read something really quick. We got so many additional testimonials from people that finished Unbound, and we can't do them all. Like, I mean, literally there's many. It would take up hours of the podcast just to show them all. So just the same. I'm going to read Beth's really quick. Beth says, "Hello, Jonathan, Ivy, and Nate. I've been training with Trainer Road for a couple of years, listening to the podcast for a little longer than that, and just completed my first race ever, Unbound 100. Another person where they're just doing their first race being Unbound.
That's awesome and also insane.
Yeah. Cool. Beth says, "I'm 52, a full-time caregiver and part-time college instructor. I had an amazing day at Unbound. I walked through the mud at the beginning of the race and rode the last 10 miles or so in a thunderstorm, and I was on cloud nine the whole time. I'm just incredibly grateful for all of it. I felt phenomenal. I feel mainly with gels, mix, and one PB&J. It sounds like an awesome day from Beth."
That's so great, Beth. Congrats.
Yeah. Good job. Hearing that you were just on cloud nine the whole time, like, it's so different from like a lot of the, right? Like a lot of the athletes, yeah, that the pro athletes in particular that did, they're like talking about that mud pit and how it was the worst thing that they've ever experienced and how the next thing happened and their world was over. Meanwhile, Beth's like, "I was on cloud nine. It was an amazing day. I'm super grateful for it." Good job.
Yeah, results, Beth, are so cool, but to know that you've prepared well enough and then execute well enough for it to actually be enjoyable is so cool, despite, you know, kind of whack circumstances and conditions. That's for amazing. Sure. That's a big dub, yeah. Beth.
Way to go, Beth. And just personally speaking, you are a hero and a saint being a full-time caregiver. That is an immensely difficult task that you've taken on. And I just have a lot of respect for you, Beth, and everybody else that's carrying heavy loads. Lots of respect. Yeah.
John's perspective is very heavy in one direction of caregiving right now.
Yes.
Yeah. This is true. That's so real for you.
Yep. Let's get into some listener questions. First from Federico, says, "Good day, Trainer Road. I have a question on nutrition during racing." This is where we're going to talk about long races. "After completing a 3-day, 4-stage race last weekend," so that means that 3 days and there are 4 stages within. So day one has 1 stage, day two has 1 stage, and day three has 2 stages on it. So 4 stages were criterium on Friday, or the 4 stages were criterium on Friday, flat TT and hill climb on Saturday, and a road race on Sunday. So in this case, it's packed into the middle, those 2 days. "The road race was 127 kilometers with 2,100 meters of elevation gain. I felt pretty good on the bike over the weekend, thanks to Trainer Road, the custom plan builder, which brought me to my best fitness ever. But I did bonk in the last 20 kilometers of the road race." Looking at your power, I'm not sure you bonked, by the way, which will clarify probably what the difference is on bonking, but we'll get into that in a bit. "On race day, I had my usual breakfast of toasts, almond butter, banana, and honey. I then sipped on a bottle with 80 grams of carbs on my way to the start and warm up. During the race, I had 2 other bottles with 80 grams each and 8 gels with 25 grams of carbs each. I took it all. So that's 360 grams of carbs for what I thought would be a 4-hour race. It ended up taking me 3 hours and 40 minutes. So that's over 100 grams of carbs, or 100 and yeah, it's over that. It's like 104 or something.
Really quick, the way that Federico's writing about this with kilometers and toasts, I think maybe they're in the UK or something.
Yeah.
Is there a chance that the toasts that they're talking about is different than from like what we consider toast? Because if I'm reading this and it's just like a slice of toasted bread, it's a big red flag for me. But I just want to make sure that there's not some
yeah, like
other version of toast that is not you know?
Right. Crisps are their chips. Biscuits are their cookies. Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's all, yeah, I see what you mean, Ivy. Yeah, 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 it could be.
Toast is probably just toast, what Frederico's talking about, right? Like toasted bread.
Yeah, and it is like, for what it's worth, that is like a really fast digesting, good sort of breakfast to have. In that regard, it's fast digesting. But typically, if you have more space, you would want to take in more than toast, right, Ivy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's probably not more than, gosh, there's just not a lot of calories in a piece of bread, in a slice of bread, you know?
They're not particularly carb dense, you know, compared to something like oats or rice or something like that. So, okay. So, Federico goes on to say, still, I completely bonked in the last half hour. I'm pretty sure I was topped off from the days prior as well, eating carb rich meals like pasta, different types of noodles, and consuming carbs during the previous shorter stages as well. So I don't know how I could have taken more carbs. Honestly, for what it's worth, it seems like they did a good job of fueling on the bike, right, Ivy? Like that's over 100 grams an hour is really rare. Not a lot of people can do that, and that seems good. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of looking at other stuff, but we'll get into that. So my question, at 6'3" and 80 kilograms, I'm a bit more on the heavier side for these types of hilly races compared to the riders around me. I read and hear in your podcast that around 90 grams per hour of carbohydrate is a good number for racing, but this number will not have the same effect on riders of different sizes, right? My stomach was able to handle everything I took during the race. There's no GI distress, but I don't know if I could have taken in more. So how can I address this? Is this a matter of doing more longer rides to improve aerobic fitness? Should I experiment taking even more carbs per hour? I do not take 90 grams per hour while training, typically 40 to 80. So it is possible that my body was not able to use all the fuel that I was putting in. Thanks again for the podcast and the Train Road app. I was really happy to finish on in top 10 GC. And I feel like you guys were a bit part of this. Awesome. I'd love to hear that. Look forward to your answers and listening to the podcast on this topic. Cheers from Federico. Ivy, before you go into this one, I just want to share one thing. I checked with Dr. Podlogar because I know he and I have spoken about this. There's ongoing research about athletes of different sizes, like different lean mass and just like different sizes in general. And if their substrate utilization rate differs between them, basically if bigger riders need more carbs than smaller riders. The research is still ongoing though, and there's not a lot of solid, you know, there's a lot of conjecture about that exists, but we want to wait until that research is done before we say that, like, yes, bigger athletes do need more carbohydrate. It very much logically makes sense, and I can bro science my way to it real quick, right? In the sense that, like, you know, more muscles equals more demand and, you know, more KJs being burned. Therefore, you should be able to take in more. But the question is there a bottleneck actually in terms of what the body can absorb just period? Or will a larger stomach or larger surface area of like small intestines and liver and everything else, does that all allow greater absorption? Who knows? So
yeah,
it would make sense, but I just don't know for sure.
Yeah. I mean, like considering that Federico didn't have any stomach issues and GI distress during that race and then the whole weekend taking in 80 grams, was it 80 grams an hour or something?
About 103 during that race, 104, I think. Yeah.
Oh, so, sorry. I was saying 80 kilograms. Sorry.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't think that Federico hit a point of, you know, taking in more than they could absorb, because I think that would probably be one of the first signs if you were, right? I mean, it is for me when I start having like GI problems and stomach issues and not feeling good. So, and I don't think they didn't fuel enough during the ride either. Yeah, I know I criticize toast. That's not like the best pre-race breakfast, but you know, such a good job of fueling during the ride, like, and that's, you know, it's not the worst pre-race breakfast. I don't think fueling was a problem.
I agree. I'll break down the race really quick, and then Ivy, if you want to come into like the things that you are recognizing in terms of what could have led to this, we'll go for it. And this is where I really do think that this is the cause. So we will put this up on the screen so other people can see Federico's race. And Federico did, so the whole race in terms of total was 3 hours and 42 minutes, like they mentioned. Normalized power of 306 watts, and that's at an FTP of 351. So that's pretty darn hard. And that's 87% FTP, basically, is what they held for 3 hours and 42 minutes. That is a capacitive style effort. That's really tough to do, to be able to hold that sort of thing. I used AI FTP detection, by the way, the model, to look at what their FTP would have been. because they were in the specialty phase going into this. They didn't update their FTP, super smart. But I used it just to double check, because what if in that case their FTP had gone up to like 360, 370, something like that. But instead of 351, it was just putting you, I believe, at 353. So it wasn't a big difference in this case. It was pretty close. So with that in mind, we can assume that the IF and everything else, all these relative numbers to their threshold, are basically accurate. So 0.87 for 3 hours and 45 minutes is really hard. But then here's the really big thing. For the first 2 hours and 20 minutes, you did 0.92 IF. So 92% of your threshold with tons of surges within there. So I know that holding stable power would be hard. Absolutely, for that. That would be extremely hard. But also in this case, when you're doing all those surges, it really starts to take a lot out of you. And that starts to rear its ugly head toward the end of a sort of effort like this. So after you did this, like for 2 hours and 20 minutes, you rode at 0.92 with tons of surges. Then you did an 8 minute threshold effort up this climb, and then you popped, and that's when your power drops down. But if you look at it, yes, your power drops, but it's not a full bonk. And the reason that I say that is a bonk is a situation where, like, your power literally, like, it's hard to push 40% FTP. That even feels strenuous, and you're like really brought down to it. Bonking is different than running out, like being tired, being fatigued, blowing up. Bonking is when, you know, you have critically low blood sugar, and then that's leading to a situation where your body can't produce the sort of effort that it would need to even get up some climbs, right? Like, you're really in a bad space. It's going to come along with not just like a foggy mental state, but an impaired mental state, even heightened emotion. There's like a lot of different things. It's a genuine like sugar crash. It's a pretty sketchy situation. So I wouldn't say you bonked. I would say that you blew up. And looking at that, it makes sense that you blew up after racing so hard for 2 hours and 20 minutes and then doing an 8 minute threshold effort. Yeah, that's going to blow you up. That sort of thing makes sense to me. But what do you see, Ivy? I don't know if you see anything else on this, or if you want to go into possibly like what you think could have caused this scenario other than the pacing, you know?
I mean, when I look at the first couple hours of that race, and I just think of the workouts that are designed to accommodate for that, you know, in that zone with float sets and over unders. And like, there's a reason why structured training works and is assigned to you for events like this to help prepare you for it. And, you know, I know Federico knows in that and believes in it because trainer and athlete. However, I do see some red flags in the past couple months of their workouts. And November to March was just so solid, hitting every workout, like really nailing it, really consistently doing structure like you should. And it's clear that you made a bunch of gains in that time. Like, where are those FTP changes? So looking like 340 watts FTP up to 351, which, you know, we see a lot of athletes that have really, really big FTP changes, right, John? Like when you're on the lower spectrum of FTP values, but when you're already at a 340 watt FTP, like to gain a couple percentage when your FTP is already so high is really, really difficult. So to go up to 351 as a result of all that time from November to March is really great. That's really impressive. Mm-hmm. And then I see Federico right outside, and make a really, really distinct shift to training outside a lot. However, I'm only seeing like one or two actual structured workouts a week. And then the outside rides that I do see associated with train road workouts are unfortunately not aligning with that workout structure much at all, or even like near the target power.
What grade would you give it if you were like a teacher giving the student a grade, Ivy? Like a D, something like that?
So again, an A plus would be you're doing every structured workout, you know, hitting your power targets. Your power profile on an outside workout or outside ride looks like what the power profile structure would look like for an inside one, right? So you're just like following the interval rest structure and hitting the power targets. That would be an A plus. An F would just be like, you're not doing any workouts. You're just riding outside and your power profile looks like a hair comb, you know?
Yeah.
That's bad. So I'm gonna give him like a D plus.
Okay, D plus. Yep. So the, there's effort, there's something there, but it just doesn't quite resemble the actual workout itself. Yeah, and I'm seeing that too, Ivy. Looking at the calendar, it goes from doing, you know, 4 structured workouts a week consistently, sometimes 5, and then going to the point of doing 1 to sometimes 3, but usually it's closer to, it's like 2. It seems like 1 to 2 workouts, structured workouts a week. And it's not necessarily that like outside is bad. It's just structure. You can do structure inside or outside, but if your ability to adhere to structure is impaired when you're outside, and that's just the balance that you have to ride there, you know, and you have to ask yourself, how is this the best scenario for it?
Right. And it's not just about adhering to structure to make more gains. Like I see that lack of adherence to structure when maybe Frederico needed to taper too. It's not just about building. So yeah, I just think this is kind of missing the forest for the trees and thinking you did all this preparation and all this volume, which you did do quite a bit of volume and it like increased, but you misattributed what went wrong to nutrition when it was really like, I don't think you did the really intentionally designed structure that would have prepared you better for an effort like this.
Yeah. It's ironic. A lot of the time what we do, a lot of us athletes, is we're more adhered to structure in the base phase than we are later on at the specialty phase. But if anything, we should be more adhered to structure in the specialty phase than anything else. But that's typically hard to do because we're filled with excitement and fitness and like we want to go use it. It's like a new toy, right?
Totally.
But in doing so, what we end up doing is we end up dosing ourselves with a lot of extra stress. And looking at that, that's the biggest red flag to me here. Well, Ivy's is a big one too, in the sense that you fell away from structure. So your guarantees also fall away when that happens. But you had a huge increase in recent TSS coming into this event, like double your recent TSS. And it was your historical high when you should have been tapering. So the whole concept of tapering is you train up toward an event and stress and fatigue is accumulating. And, you know, every fourth week is an easy week where it's the stress is dropped down to try to help you adapt to the 3 weeks of loading that you've been doing. And you're kind of like riding this tide and it may be slowly increasing or staying around the same as you get closer to your event, you get into the specialty phase. And then what happens is your training stress drops because what we're hoping to do is, yes, if you were to continue to train through, you might have more fitness in terms of like more power, strength on the bike, but your ability to express that fitness is always governed by how tired you are. And if you're too fatigued coming into an event, you can have tons of fitness, but you won't be able to use it. So that's the whole point of a taper and the point of the specialty phase is to give you these very specific workouts to what you do. And since they're more specific to what you're doing, they also will drop in duration a bit and they'll drop in total volume. So then that way you're getting the sort of work that matters on race day, but you're getting it in the dosage that allows you to recover from it. So then that way you can get stronger and be fresh on race day. So in your case, instead of doing a taper, you actually reached the highest TSS you've ever done. And it was double what you've done recently. And that's like another part of this. I feel like that people may not understand of training stress, right, Ivy, in the sense that just because I've done 800 TSS in the past doesn't mean that I can go from doing 400 TSS to 800 TSS and expect, well, my body will remember it because I've done this before. It's, it's yes, it's relative to what you've done, you know, at some point in your life, but that carries much less weight than what you've done recently. It is very much relative to what you've done recently. And if you do a rapid increase, that increase in strain, your body is not prepared to be able to absorb all of that. So what ends up happening if in this sort of like a severe case of going up to like to 800 TSS and doing that just, you know, kind of in a 1 week to the next and going into your event, it's going to just make you be really fatigued. That's why things are gradually controlled. And that's why training plans really help with that.
John, has a taper ever stressed you out? It seems like we
all the time.
We want a reason. It's easy to reason that, you know, I've done all of this work and it has resulted in this fitness. Why would I step off right now? And then especially looking back on rest weeks, when you are fully chilling, fully resting and coming back and doing really hard workouts after that and how horrible it feels. And so I kind of assign some of that you know, anxiety to a taper too. I'm like, oh my God, like last time I chilled this hard and then I came back and it was awful. And so I don't want to taper. And so I wonder if, you know, that's the reason why some athletes kind of charge through their taper, because why would you back down now, you know?
Yeah, it makes no sense in our minds that like doing less is somehow going to make us do more on race day, right? Like that doesn't make sense. But it's there's a lot of anxiety attached to that too, where we want affirmations that our fitness is strong coming into an event. And the way that we do that is we go out and we push ourselves to new limits because we want to see that we are at unprecedented points in our fitness. So then that way we can come into the race thinking, I'm more ready than I ever have been. So all of that makes sense. But this is when the best athletes are, like, in terms of the ones that perform the best consistently, they're the ones that have a tapering strategy that works and they trust in it and they go through with it. So it's, I was just talking to Sophia actually after this, cause she's taken, you know, like most athletes after Unbound have likely taken a little bit of time. Some athletes haven't, and they just like kept racing. Sophia had like took a little bit of time off. And then I was talking to her like, how's your training going? And she's like, oh, like this week off, you know, like it might make the next few workouts hard, but man, it's going to pay off soon. Like I cannot wait. And that's something that I feel like, what a cool thing to see that even at that level, when you're paid for it and it's your job and it's like, you're either winning, and for her, it's like winning or nothing, right? Like she's very competitive, yet she still is able to maintain this perspective that this is totally this time off. And I know that we're not talking about tapering directly there, but the principles are still the same. This time off will pay dividends later on. But it's also important to remember that a taper isn't time off. A taper is, and this is where I think a lot of athletes miss. They will go too hard and then they'll skip 1, 2, 3 days because they went too hard, you know, on whatever sort of group ride or whatever. They just overshot the targets on a workout. They did something. So
recovery from that, when you like dig yourself into a hole and like have to take a few days off, is totally different from a, you know, intelligently designed build and rest, you know?
Yes. I would rather get in 30-minute workouts going into those, you know, like something short. You do a 30-minute workout, but it emulates the sort of things that you're going to do on race day. If it's short, hard, repeated efforts, if it's long, sustained efforts, whatever it is. I'd rather do a 30-minute workout every day leading into a race, and I say every day, every prescribed day that I have on my plan, than try to just like give myself this big affirmation by blowing my brains out on the bike and showing that like, wow, that was a lot of power. I now know, after lots of tapering and lots of going through this and seeing many, many athletes go through this, it is absolutely the best approach just to stick to the plan and err on the side of caution and to not even get curious about what's on the other side of the fence. When you're talking about the 2 weeks leading into your event, it's so crucial. So, and I think that this is in my mind. So yes, you fell off of structure. So that might've not prepared you the best because like Ivy said, you had these workouts that are more specific for your event. And when those are starting to come around, you were doing less of them and you were doing them less specifically. So that's one thing. But the big thing I see is just you set yourself up for fatigue coming into this. And keep in mind, like we're talking a stage race here. So there's cumulative fatigue from day to day that they're also dealing with. So then Federico, you had a lot of stress coming in and your body was trying to figure out what to do with all that, trying to adapt to as much as it could, probably couldn't adapt to a lot of that because it was too much. And then you're going into this race environment, and you're adding even more stress from the bike and then more stress off the bike into it. And it makes sense that your performance would suffer. All of that said, incredible performance in terms of power output for that race. If you had been properly tapered, you would have had an absolute standout like performance. I'm not sure where you placed. I'm not sure what your goal was in terms of that, or if you even had one, but irrelevant to that, just your power is very impressive as is. And it would have been even more impressive had you had a good taper. So tapers, those sort of things that cause fatigue, they rear their ugly heads toward the end of races. That seems like, you know, cause that's when fatigue is peaking.
Oh, Federico said finish top 10 in GC.
Impressive, right? Yeah. And I don't know what, you know, the gaps were or anything else on this one, but, you know, I would assume that you would have been able to hold that sort of power for the rest of it. And that would have been a profound like difference in the result for sure.
I feel like I'm such a harsh critic, and you know, it's important to say that I am also not perfect, you know.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. None of us are in ivory towers over here. Like, we're all like, but it's the there's the benefit of having outside perspectives, I think, is always helpful. And we should always adopt that perspective. Like, look at it from an outside in perspective. Am I doing this as well as I could? And just take a step. You don't have to be perfect one day to the next. Just take a step toward better, you know? So, All right, let's get into Ben's question. Ben says, are there any drawbacks in becoming heat adapted? Keeping it short. You know, we love you guys. Ben, that's amazing. Well done. Short question. That was great. Yeah. We also like detail when you can provide it as well. So
there are two types of questions. One like this one, like Ben's, and the other is like, when my parents met, when I was a child.
That's right. We love you all.
Yeah.
The question, are there any drawbacks to becoming heat adapted? Not directly, as long as you're replenishing the amount of fluid you're losing and the amount of sodium, you know, electrolytes that you're losing. There isn't a drawback to it directly from being more heat adapted. However, the process of heat adaptation, yes, that will blunt like the effect of your training that you're getting. So I want to run through things basically and just kind of like give everybody a basic overview and reminder in terms of how sweating works. I know that seems possibly a bit silly, but how sweating works, and then also how heat adaptation works in this regard. And then it'll make sense how it could affect our training adversely. So like that, your body, it cools itself and it has circulatory cooling and evaporative cooling. Some people also like to refer to things as convective, but I'm just going to refer to it in terms of those two kind of effects, and they're absolutely inherently related. So circulatory, and the way that this works, I mean, your body in working muscle tissue and the cells within there, you generate a lot of heat when you're working, right? And that heat needs to be pulled away from the muscles and the cells. The way that does that is through blood circulation. And it pulls that heat away by passing the blood, nearby. It ends up pulling it away. And as a result, it's able to kind of like balance that out. So if your legs are working like crazy and other parts of your body aren't quite as hot, it's able to pass that through and kind of reach an equilibrium and help balance things out. And that's helpful. But really, it pulls it closer to the skin, which is where it can escape more easily. And it does this through the process of sweating. And what we sweat out is intercellular fluid. It's blood plasma, effectively, so that's where all that comes from. And what it's going to do in those cases is, as it brings that intercellular fluid up close to the surface through the blood, it's able to pass through pores. You sweat it out, and then the body has this amazing trick where it uses science, of course, to evaporate once it gets to your skin. And that evaporative process has a cooling effect to the tissue that it's on there. So it's really cool. Our body has this whole process that it goes through to cool itself off. It's got like radiators, just like you would see in a car, and it passes the fluid around the cylinder and then pulls it back through so it can cool off. And if only your engines could sweat, then it would be a direct comparison to it. But no, our engines don't.
John, you can't be a science guy and a car guy in one segment. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I break the mold. But you have to think about this. So when you, and to use the car analogy, I'm sure, I don't know if any of you like have had older cars. I remember an older truck that I had. Like if I was driving and I needed to really make a pass, and it was a slow truck and I needed to make a pass by somebody, I would turn off my AC because I get a little power boost, you know, like, and because you're running that AC pump and your engine is putting out a certain amount of power. And when you run that AC pump, it takes some of that power to be able to run it, right? And then that's less power for you to drive fast down the road. Just like you in this regard, like you're running an AC pump to cool your body. And the harder that has to work, the more of the finite resources that you have get allocated to that, and the less get allocated to power. So this is just a simple scenario that if your body is having to work harder to cool itself, that means that it can't produce as much power. And that ends up, from a training perspective, if you can't produce as much power, that means there's less potential stimulus that you're dosing your body with. It's just like training at lower wattages, right? So imagine doing all of, instead of your threshold power, you're doing, or threshold workouts, you're doing sweet spot intervals instead. You know, you might be able to recover easier from that, but it's less strain that's specific to what you want. And as a result, you might not get faster as a result of that. So this is something that's really important to keep in mind. More work on the cooling side means less potential stimulus, which means less potential adaptation from your training.
That analogy or example actually was really good. You're forgiven.
Nice.
That makes sense. There you
go. Forerunner people unite. You know, Forerunners, you got in old Tacomas and stuff. You had to throw off the AC to pass people on two-way roads. So, but that's the whole kind of like concept here. And that's why if you are undergoing a heat adaptation protocol, it's almost always recommended that you do it in conjunction with low intensity training, where you aren't trying to achieve a specific benefit with higher intensity workouts, because you simply won't be able to work as hard. So that's why they recommend that you do it with low intensity training. However, that still doesn't mean that it has no effect. Maybe in those low intensity workouts, let's just assign an arbitrary like fatigue score that you get from something like that. Maybe it's a fatigue score of 10 out of 100 that you would normally get from that endurance workout. But now that you're doing it in really hot conditions, it ends up increasing that to like a 25 or a 35. And if you think of this in terms of you have to be at a baseline of zero in order to adapt to your training, that means you have to spend more time recovering from that to get to the point where you can actually absorb the benefits of your training. So there is an opportunity cost, really, with heat adaptation. That's typically why people are doing it toward the end in the specialty phase, because then at that point, they're not focused on getting additional gains. Instead, they're focusing on getting fresher and maybe just sharpening the sword with a bit more specificity. And that's why it's tied in there. I do want to cover something, though, because the question kind of naturally comes up, like, okay, so if it's hot outside, I'm not intentionally doing heat training, should I be keeping this in mind and should I be adjusting my power targets as a result of this? Or, you know, cause otherwise I could be working too hard. And there is no clear, like with elevation, you can say that like when you go up this much, you can drop your FTP by this much. And that's how you can understand your pacing and your workouts and everything else. And there is no chart like that for heat. Your mileage may vary. Absolutely. And it'd be great to see more research on this to see if there is general consensus where we could have like a chart on it. There's no direct comparison.
And there's a difference in heat adaptation protocol between athletes, right? Like some folks just go to a hot area and actually train in the heat. And there are other riders that train in, you know, as warm a weather as they can, but still need to go do something like sit in a sauna for an extended period of time after they train, like immediately after. And so, you know, I'm sure that would influence how you would adjust or account for any power changes too, depending upon how you approach it, right?
Yeah, 100%. And you just outlined the like recommended heat adaptation protocols. For that, go to the Science of Getting Faster podcast. We talked to Dr. Chris Minson, who's one of the foremost researchers on this. And he breaks down heat training very well. Very articulate, super fun to listen to. Great guy. I believe that's episode 1 of the Science of Getting Faster podcast. So go check that one out. It's really good. He even talks about how he did this like crazy multi-sport like crossing of the state of Oregon, where they were just like going through like gnarly conditions where they were rafting at one point and then hiking or riding a bike and like all the different things that they did to like test and collect data for that. And then also in lab environments, a test. And it's quite interesting. So check that one out. And Dr. Minson, I know that you're a listener to the podcast. If you're listening right now, good to have you on and we appreciate all your work. I do want to share one study that's I do want to share one study that's commonly referenced for this, and this is a 2020 study. I think it's 2002. I wrote that down wrong. I believe it's 2002. I could be wrong here, but it's from Tatterson and colleagues. It's called "The Effects of Heat Stress on Physiological Responses and Exercise Performance in Elite Cyclists," and this one is. It's commonly referenced as like kind of like a suggestion I've heard from coaches in the coaching community across the board, but I want to point out that this is just one study. So it's hard for us to say that this is like a suggestion across the board. And it's also dealing with a specific temperature range in terms of what sorts of power decreases they saw with heat increase. So they had 11 pro cyclists. They had them do 2 30-minute time trials at different temperatures or like different environments. One of them was at 32 degrees Celsius or 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That was the high temp test. And then there was the low temp test, and that was 23 degrees Celsius or 73 degrees Fahrenheit. And they measured core temp and power output. And what they found was that core temp actually was remarkably similar between the two circumstances. However, perceived perceived heat and experience absolutely reflected the change in temperature. And power was 6.5% lower in the high temperature group. So you could look at this and you could say, okay, so somewhere around, you know, 15 to 20 degrees increase from 73 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit means that I should have a, I should expect 6.5% lower power output. But again, that's only dealing with this specific example, and we don't have a large body of evidence to draw any sort of conclusions from. So you could look at that, and if you're trying to understand, you know, you're doing a TT and you're trying to pace yourself and you're trying to figure out how to not cook in the heat, you could do that. But it's so important to remember that RPE is king and that heat ramps up and will sneak up on you. So you can start out conservatively, and that's smart to do in hot conditions. And then once you are recognizing the heat, it's important to then ride by RPE. Assuming that you've ridden conservatively, hopefully that allows you to keep a somewhat stable power output throughout and then have, you know, the fastest overall time if you're in like a TT or a triathlon position or anything like that. So yeah, to recap, no, it won't, it doesn't make you slower. There aren't any downsides to it other than the opportunity cost that it presents with training, but heat inevitably makes you slower on the bike. That's just how it works. It's, more work for your body to be able to cool itself and less work to push the pedals. Yeah. Shane's question. Hey, Trainer Road Crew, I have a 3-day gravel stage race coming up in July that is about 330 miles. So that's roughly about 110 miles a day. I anticipate this will be around 6-ish hours a day. My question is, how should I pace the effort? Most 1-day amateur gravel races in northern Minnesota start out redlining threshold for not even threshold. They're redlining VO2 and anaerobic, man, for the first 20 minutes or so. And if you manage to hang on to the lead group, then you're usually latched on for the rest of the race. I want to play it smart and not make early unnecessary hard efforts, but I also don't want to risk getting dropped earlier on either. How would you suggest I do this? Is there an acceptable time frame to go hard early to hold on to an early break, or is it always better to be conservative and manage a more steady zone 2 effort for what will be likely nearly 20 hours of racing over the 3 days? For context, I'm 45 years old, have been racing for years, but only using Trainer Road consistently for 4 years now, and I'm in the best shape of my life. Good to hear it, Shane. Getting close to my goal of 4 watts per kilogram. Thanks so much. Way to go. It's a good club to work your way into. You're almost there.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Mm-hmm. Ivy, do you want to kick us off on this one? It's like a 3-day stage race, and people will probably start hard, but what should they be doing?
Yeah, I just did that conversion too. That's 531 kilometers. I feel bad I'm trying to do that more because we talk about miles and feet and pounds a lot. Sorry, y'all.
American.
Yeah, I mean, Shane is really fit, you know, and I don't think that throwing it into zone 2 for the entire 3 days should be the strategy. What stood out to me is I want to play it smart and not make unnecessary hard efforts but don't want to risk getting dropped early on either. I feel like the folks that are going, like, you're pretty fast, Shane, and the folks that are going really, really hard, like you're talking about in those races in the first 20 minutes or so, that's a super mixed bag in my experience. Maybe John, you can confirm, either the people that are super winning the race, or people that are not gauging their effort appropriately and are going to massively blow up in the next hour or in the next day, you know? Yeah. Do you think that's accurate?
Oh yeah. And especially since this is multi-day, on day 2, there will be less of them. And on day 3, there will be much less of them in terms of the people that are starting so hard, and they should not be starting that hard.
Right.
So I completely agree, Ivy.
There could be, I just really don't foresee a course being like this. They could know something you don't know about the course. And so you should, before going into this race, really familiarize yourself with the course, the elevation specifically. Make little cue sheets for your top tube if you have to, at what mile or kilometer mark a climb begins and ends. And, you know, if someone's going really hard in the first 20 minutes, like, I can't think of any race I've done that's like this, but maybe there's a really significant climb in the first, you know, like, hour of that really long day. And then from there on, it's a long descent and then flat chill time. Like, I don't think I don't think they know something you don't know. And you can really blow the whole race and the whole weekend, all three stages, if you ride, to not get dropped by those people. And it feels like you're experienced enough in training and engaging your own effort that you know where that limit should be, to not go into the red, but do a little bit of intensity to try to race within your group and find where your place is in that race. And the way to not do that is see how long you can hang with the people that are riding as hard as they can in the first 20 minutes. Like, that's a great way to blow it for the rest of the day and the weekend.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
there's so much potential downside to that, right? To going so hard. And there's very little potential, like, upside to it. I know they're saying that they could stay with a group, but what I've found in situations like this is that if you start easier, you're going to constantly be coming across people that are blowing backwards, and they're not just going to be like soft pedaling. They're going to be trying really hard. So you'll be able to kind of like leapfrog and like almost like interval train your way through the race, in the sense that they'll be like, you get with a group and you'll be able to rest up a little bit, and then you'll bridge through to the next group. And then that'll kind of be on repeat. And especially since it's not like single track or anything else that you're dealing with, like long sustained single track sections, or it doesn't seem like that. I think that it's, you'll actually have a faster overall time if you do that. And then by day two or three, more people will be doing what you're doing. So you'll find more company from the beginning and throughout the day, because they'll all be recognizing the fact that, like, oh, I bit off too much and I'm going to go a whole lot slower on the start. I'm not going to go crazy. I'm not going to try to ride with the people that actually have the fitness to win. Mm-hmm. And it's going to make it so that you have more people to work with and you can save more energy.
I do want to advise, I feel like when you're trying to find your group, what people think that that looks like and what they often do is ride with some people and wait till they get so far in the red, you know, like VO2 max zone, to be like, whoops, this is not my group. And then they let themselves fall back. And really, a better strategy is when you feel yourself starting to get near that FTP zone. Like, for me, that's obviously not a sustainable pace to ride for, you know,
6 hours, potentially
100 miles a day, 3 days in a row. And so that's the point where it starts to get like medium to medium high, kind of uncomfortable, that I let off the gas and let that group go and be like, this isn't my group. And it's so weird and so hard to do, to just be like doing a medium effort and like, bye guys, there could be like the winner of the race. Mm-hmm. See you later. But that's what you have to do if you want to feel like you can really make it through a long race and multiple stages with plenty of gas left at the end, you know?
Oh yeah. I was flat out mocked, like at Leadville. Like, we, at the bottom of Powerline, I caught up to like a bunch of guys and they were like, oh, Coach Jonathan. And they're like, let's rip some poles. And they started pulling way too hard. And I pulled through easy. And one of them was like, that's all you got, man? And I'm like, yeah, that's all I got. And they, and I just, like, the next time when I got to the back of the line, I just kept holding my pace and they just rolled through. And I remember all of them were like, come on, man, how can you drop off? Like, you know, you're Coach Jonathan, you should be with us. And I'm good, man. Like, I'm just like, I got a lot of race ahead and I'm just holding my power. Like, you have to know what's sustainable. Now, when you're talking about the last half of the last day, the final 3 hours, right, Ivy? That's the sort of time when you can throw caution to the wind more and you can really start to like push yourself and go for it. Or maybe it's earlier on even in the last day. But the worst time to do it is in the first day, because then that's going to handicap the rest of your race.
Mm-hmm. You know, you could even do it in the final like hour or so of, you know, stages one and two, especially if you're like with a group that you're racing with and feeling like you're in a good position. Like, sure, feel emboldened to go into the red. Just make sure you, you know, I would for sure pack more nutrition than you think you need for this.
Yeah,
like Keegan's strategy, I don't know, does that episode premiere today?
Yeah.
You know, bringing extra gels and food in case he had to do a big effort and bridge solo as a result of like a flat or mechanical or something, like planning on that. And so, you know, plan on, okay, I might be in a position where I'm racing for top five or top 10 or something in the last hour of this, you know, stage one or stage two. That's also a time to be like, okay, I can go into the red a little bit. I can see what sticks here. But I think what we agree upon, John, is that the first 20 minutes or first few hours of each stage is not the time to do that and test it out and go into the red.
For sure. aside from the pacing stuff, I just want to give like some general advice. Shane, eat so much, like so much. Like when you're off the bike, is if you can, I don't know what the circumstances are for this race, but if you can, have some sort of a meal ready that you can have directly after. If that's like a sandwich, if that's just rice and eggs that you can bring, and then like you have them ready, like eat right after and eat a meal after you're done. Maybe taking a recovery shake too. After that, don't be afraid to eat more. Like you should over the course of these 3 days and really the day before too. So 4 days, you could even start 2 days before with carb loading, but typically 1 day, you know, 1 to 2 days is what they recommend. But you should be so tired of eating, and eating should feel like a real challenge. And I know that doesn't sound like healthy, but you have to remember what you're doing here is you're fueling your body for performance. And your body isn't used to that, and it isn't normal. Like, it isn't what you're going to sustain outside of this race, that sort of a thing. But it's overall healthier for you, because in that race, it's going to put you in a spot where you're going to have the energy that you need to be able to get through it. So like an example of what you might eat before the race, you'll have something that's like really carb rich and really simple. So it's not going to be something that's going to take a long time to break down. You're going to try to avoid fiber throughout this race for sure. So minimize fiber in every food choice that you can make. For me, what I would eat before that is I would probably eat something like, I don't know, like 2 to 3 cups of rice cooked of dry rice that I've cooked. That's a lot of rice. I would eat that, and then I would have some egg in there, and that would probably be my pre-race meal. I'm going to take in 100 grams an hour of carbs all throughout the race. And then after the race, I'm going to take in some sort of meal that I can afterward. And then if that's around lunchtime, then I'm probably going to eat a second lunch in the afternoon. Then I'm going to let myself snack. And then when we get to dinner, I'm going to eat a big dinner. That dinner is where I'm going to get in a bit more variety in my nutrition, because I don't have a race right after it. But I'm still going to try to stay away from fiber, still try to stay away from super high fat options, that sort of thing. And then before I go to bed, I'm going to top off with something like cereal. And then when I get up the next morning, I'm going to do it again. And that is hard to do, and it'll get like tiresome. But if you're doing that and you're constantly drinking as well, it's going to make it feel like you have turbo boosters on your bike on the final day, and even on the second day, even on the first. And other people will be really slowing down. So like, stage races, particularly long ones with big days like this, I can't emphasize that enough, how important it is to fuel just like crazy. And I think I was undergunned at Cape Epic in terms of power against a lot of the people that we are racing against, but we were beating them. And the reason that we were beating them is because toward the latter half of the stages, we were just ripping through the field every single day. And I think it was because of energy. It was what we were feeling with on the bike, and then off the bike, we were constantly eating a ton.
You ate yourself sick. I think you were like so bored tired of force feeding yourself, right?
Yes. 8 or 9 days of it, you know, like it got hard for sure. Like I can't imagine Grand Tour riders, because they like so much more than I did even, you know? It would just, and for 3 weeks, I can't imagine what it's like to go through a Grand Tour, you know? So, but Shane, it helps so much if you can eat like that. If Nate was here, he'd be telling you all about this and, you know, blue in the face as he has been in the past on this, because it really does help. So, but even if you have the best nutrition, if you don't follow that pacing advice from Ivy of riding within yourself in the beginning, it's going to all blow up. So. Yeah. Only time where I think where that doesn't make sense, Ivy, is if it's like a single track style race and you are racing for a specific position that you really want to go for, you need to race for that position. But it's still worth saying, if you're racing for, you know, 10th to 20th, don't be racing with first to 10th. Like, don't pace off of them. Pace around 10th to 20th, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Familiarizing yourself with the course beforehand too will really help, you know. Mm-hmm. Hope you know exactly what to aim for and where the times to go hard are and are not. Yeah.
Yeah. Great points for sure. Okay. Emily's question. The optimal time for me to train daily is in the evenings, right after family dinner in my house. Hosts, how do you recommend fueling in this instance? I could eat dinner with my family and then train and finish with a recovery shake, or I could eat only a small portion with my family before training and then finish the rest of my dinner after training. Sitting at the table and having a meal together is important in our house, and I'm wondering how other evening trainers handle this. So I think, Ivy, we should call out for other athletes that are, that have, that do this very thing. Cause there's a lot of athletes, I'm sure, listening to this, that, that train in the evenings. If you train in the evening, how do you balance that? If you have like a family that you typically have dinners with and that sort of thing, how do you balance it with that? How do you balance it with just your dinner period, whether it's with people or not, and sleep? It'd be great to hear a lot of different perspectives. So then we could share them on here, on a upcoming episode, to then further, help Emily even more in this case. But Ivy, what are your thoughts in this situation?
Man, I would definitely eat a smaller dinner with your family. Going into workout with a really full belly is always tricky for me, especially at nighttime. Like I kind of get a little, I get the sleepies, and you know, when I have like a huge meal, and then it's really hard to motivate to get on the bike, and then you have a huge gut and start like burping and feeling really full on the bike. It's not a good vibe. So if I were Emily, I would have a small meal with your family, hang out, do your workout, and then afterwards eat another helping of small dinner and a protein shake, both of them. That's what I would do. What would you do?
Yeah, the same. I would probably pick like the most simple carb option that is on the table or something and eat that with them, right?
If you're doing like, you know, like pasta with like red meat sauce and like salad or greens and a side vegetable, don't like eat the veg salads. Like, oh, I'll have the dinner salad first before I train and then a bunch of pasta afterwards, you know?
Yeah.
You might think that you should do that because you want to eat something like light so that you don't have like a big, full, heavy belly before you get on the trainer. But
yes. Assuming that we're maintaining the priority of together time at the table, and that's the first thing, but not together in the sense of you're eating everything that everybody else is eating. Assuming that's okay, what I would recommend in this case is that you sit down and you have something like we talked about earlier, toast with honey, something that's going to like digest really quickly and isn't hard. Toast with jam, something simple. Yeah, Ivy.
What if Emily has little toddlers? And
perfect.
No, and what if she sits down and she's eating like fruit snack candy and like toast with like sugar jam, and the kids are like, "Well, mom doesn't have to eat broccoli. What the heck?"
Yeah, it's true. That could be contentious. Good point. I hadn't thought of that. But you do want to eat stuff that would just like not cause distress. So you could do that. You know, the other thing that you could do too, and for me, I don't adjust my family's schedule around my schedule. And what we do is like for dinner, we almost always eat together, but there are situations where like I have to get in my workout and for some reason I'm having to do it later. And as a result, I'm not able to make it back for dinner in time. And then in those situations, what we always do is we still just make sure that we get the together time. So I don't mean to suggest that this isn't a valuable tradition. It's like the most valuable one, like family time together around a dinner table is amazing. But if you can't do that, you can still prioritize the family time away from the dinner table and you can still have something. Granted, that can be hard on a family. And if that's the case, and if it's like a consistent thing, then I can totally understand not wanting to change it. But I just want to make sure that that's also like an option that, you know, maybe you train right around dinner time. But then after that, what you end up doing is y'all like hang out and, you know, play a game or just read books together. I don't know. That's like the sort of stuff that we do as a family. It's a card game or it's books or something like that. So you can do that very thing and you can still get in that together time. But regardless, in terms of like what you would want to eat, you would not want to eat the salad. You wouldn't want to eat the fatty foods or the fibrous foods first. You would want to eat the most simple option. And then you can expect possibly some gut distress if you're taking in something like whole grain pasta, for example, that's not going to digest that quick. You know, you can probably push through it just fine. I would still nourish yourself on the bike. Don't think that just because you had something just before it means that you shouldn't eat on the bike too. I would still eat on the bike. And then when you're done with it, then you could like, you know, finish up with something else. Just keep in mind that post-workout, you know, it might be a good opportunity for a recovery drink. And then if you have something that's like more fibrous, like vegetables or anything else, you could also have those just the same thereafter. But it's a hard one. Athletes that train at night or in the evenings, will you let us know down in comments below here? And then also send in your questions at trainerroad.com/podcast. Send in how you manage your training in the evenings and if you have family, even better, then you can share how that works. And then we'll share that on a future episode. So Before we get into the hot takes, I wanted to read like a quick thing from Damon. This one wasn't a question, but just they sent in. They said, just a quick anecdote on how effective trainer road low volume plans can be. Back in my 30s, I raced triathlons seriously for years, often training 15 to 20 hours per week, including all day rides on the weekends. But I took a 10-year hiatus, and this year I found myself age 46 with two very young kids, but wanting to give it another go. I signed up for a recent 70.3 and trained using the half Ironman plan, low volume, and I followed it closely, including in only regular or including or adding in, forgive me, only regular strength work. I did no outdoor rides. I didn't have the time, and almost no trainer rides over 90 minutes. At the 70.3 race this weekend, despite being 10 years older and having serious life obligations and being time constrained, I set a 10-minute overall PR, a 15-minute bike PR. They've managed 2 hours and 18 minutes at 24.2 mile an hour average. That's insane. And snagged
this is someone that used to used to train almost 20 hours a week, every week.
Yes.
And all of a sudden they do low volume and are that much faster. That's crazy. Yeah.
It's amazing. They even got a top 10 age group finish. I give Trainer Road huge credit for making that possible. And this fall, I'll happily give up my my locked in monthly rate because I think the value more than justifies it. Many thanks for a great product. It's awesome. And to be clear, like, you know, we're not saying that we have any like indication of raising prices or anything, which is what Damon's saying is that by the time he gets to the fall, his locked in rate that he has will end up, as we've talked about before with our locked in customers, we give you the option for a year to be able to continue to pay the current rate that you have or to pay a discounted rate or to pay the current rate. It's just all up to you. We give everybody the choice. If you're able to, and if you have a locked in rate and you're able to pay more, that will just help us hire more people and build even more cool features. So we greatly appreciate it. If you think it's worth it, go ahead. That would be awesome. We thought that was the right thing to do in that situation. So Damon, we appreciate you using Trainer Road and you give us a lot of credit. And thank you for that. But we also give you a lot of credit because you did the hard work. Pretty cool to see what a low volume plan
That's
can
so
do.
Awesome. I love that.
Right? Yeah. All right, Ivy, do you want to finish up with some hot takes?
Yes, I do. These are wild. Okay.
Yes, some of them are.
First one, the Peloton could really learn from triathletes and pee on the bike, Jonathan.
Yeah. I think so. I don't know. But then again, it's built into like the pro Peloton's behavior to take nature breaks in the men's and women's fields. So I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know. I do have something for this, though. Some of you might think this is gross. And some of you cyclists are probably thinking, oh, my gosh, what's happened to you? I'm not advocating for just peeing in your chamois. Instead, this was shared by an ultra racer that I know. And also, I spoke to a friend who races UTVs in like long scale off-road races. They also use this. It's by PCI Race Radios. And this is for dudes only. There might be a women's solution that I don't know of that's feasible on a bike, but I'm just not sure of it. But for dudes only, it's a male external racing catheter kit. And I know what you're thinking. What in the world? That's really gross. I'll even post a link to it so you can see. Look, like it's got a hose. You could cut the hose so that it's just, you know, just like above the bib short line. And then that way, if you really needed to go, you could just roll up your bib shorts a bit and then point the hose away from you and you could go. I'm just saying it could help. It could save like, you know, 5-10 minutes. It's an option. Am I
trying to support you
this?
So hard right now? I'm trying to support you.
I don't know. I don't know. It could save time in gravel racing. People are upsetting the apple cart constantly, right? In the terms of like not following tradition. Mm-hmm. Eventually in road racing, it's also going to happen as well. I think tradition will start to go away and people won't respect typical tactics that we've seen of like the respectful tactics where people wait for the yellow jersey and that sort of thing. I think it'll all go away. Right. And if so, maybe people will use these catheters where they can, you know, pee out of their shorts through a hose. You know,
yeah.
You could even point that hose in a specific direction. I don't know. That's gross. I don't want to think about that, but just the same worst things have happened on bikes. But anyways, I crazy for thinking of this or maybe other people have better solutions. Maybe there's a solution for women that I don't know about as well. If so, people should comment. I'm sorry, everybody.
Me too. I'm sorry.
What's next? Let's move on.
All right. Well, kind of on a somewhat similar note, bike shorts are better than bibs, nearly as comfortable and way easier to disrobe when nature calls.
What do you think?
I disagree. I find the waistbands in cycling shorts to like put unnecessary pressure on my like stomach torso area. And then if, you know, if I don't want as much pressure and I'm a seamstress and I sew. And so like I have in the past taken the elastic out of those and done like a bigger, looser piece of elastic. So there's not so much pressure. And then when you do that, they fall down, you know?
Yeah.
No one wants like to be behind plumber crack on the bike. So I respectfully disagree with this take. Yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, next time you're on a bike ride, look at how high up everybody's jerseys are after a while of riding. And that's why it's a good idea that we don't have that, at the very least just for sunburns. Like, you know, like your jersey would ride up and you would have like a mid-drift going on. Also, our guts like expand and contract a ton on the bike with, you know, the eating and everything else. And so you have to, that's the nice part about bibs and having that, like, you know, without having the elastic band. So I agree. And but I do agree that, like, you know, way easier to disrobe when nature calls. But once again, just use a external catheter kit and you're fine. You know, so.
Oh, man.
Or for women, the women's bibs are like super smart with that. Like Velocio has these bibs that like are designed to stretch and conform to allow you to use the restroom like reasonably. There's options out there for sure.
Fellow,
I think Osos has one with a clip.
Nice. Yeah. Fellow Ventum athlete, Chelsea Bolton, I think her last name is. Sorry, Chelsea, if you're listening. We talked about a little sewing project that she did with a little e-hook that you can get online to cut and sew this metal clasp, this hook that's super easy to do in the back of your bibs. So she cut the top of her bib strap, sewed this hook on, and then sewed a loop in the bottom part so that she could easily take it off in the back.
Huh, clever.
To go to the bathroom. Yeah, super sneaky. Yeah, really cool.
Yep. Yeah, so there's options, like homebrew options. There's ones that you can buy. So on the women's side, at the very least, you know, there's like good options for that. But for the dudes, I already said my option, and I won't say it anymore.
Oh my gosh. I just feel like those are meant for people that, you know, are trying to stand in line for a Taylor Swift concert for like 10 hours.
I hope not. I mean, they're designed.
And they like don't want to move from their spot in line or something.
I hope not. They're used for off-road truck racers, I think. But yeah, I mean, I can see that. I'm sure they've been used for T-Swift too. So,
yeah. All right. Next hot take. One by Eagle is the only gravel one by setup worth building. I wonder why this athlete said this, you know, why Eagle specifically. What about Eagle makes it the best for gravel, you know?
Yeah, Explore. SRAM has the Explore one. Those are like more gravel-oriented cassette ranges where it'll be 10 to like 42 or 10 to 40 or like 10 to 36. So those will be a lot tighter. So then that way, if you're doing like a lot of pace lines and that sort of stuff and having that right gear does make a difference, that's great. So no, I mean, I disagree with it. I think that Eagle isn't the only one. Yeah.
No. Especially with, I just upgraded to that Explore derailleur also. With the Axis, it's super easy to switch between like when I want.
So nice.
And like I do. Yeah. And I do want to keep for cross, like a tighter gear range just so that those jumps aren't so heavy. So it'll just be really easy on that, on my bike to just, on my Ventum to just throw the, switch those derailleurs and the cassettes over between like really long gravel training or long hard gravel races or rides. And then when I want the more compact group set, just switch the derailleur over. Super easy.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's a good one. And also one by in general, I know a lot of people dislike it. I think it's just, it's like if you, for road racing, yes, it's probably not best. For TTs where you're having a narrower range of speed variation, I think it makes a lot of sense. Depending on the course. But for gravel racing and stuff, I think it's the only way to go. And the reason for that is because a front derailleur is a lot of liability. It could break, it could not function. It could get clogged, mud gets on it, and then it no longer functions. And then you're stuck halfway in between Whereas if you have a one by with narrow wide chainring, like all one by should be using, and a clutch derailleur, which once again, every derailleur should have a clutch in it. It's just so much better for keeping the chain on and not allowing gears to skip. And then you have like a tiny little chain guide, and then it's just like, it's bulletproof, and there's a lot less moving parts, a lot less things that can go wrong. It's just a better option.
Road racing may be different, but. Yeah. The range of gears that you can have on a cassette when you have a derailleur that can accommodate it, like the Explorer, is like amazing. It's awesome. Yeah. I don't really think you need to do a front derailleur for gravel anymore.
Yeah. An Eagle's cool, particularly if you're doing gravel races in the like in our sort of terrain where sometimes you're climbing insanely steep stuff and you know you need a wide range, a really wide range, but it's not the only one. I will be using it though for Unbound. If I get into Unbound, I'm going to be using the transmission one because I want durability. I'm going to be using the Axo cassette. I think I already mentioned that on the podcast. Anyways,
The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast is not brought to you by SRAM today, just by the way.
Like Shimano just needs to step it up and match them. You know, that's all.
We're just fanboys, so, you know, it's not our fault.
I'm just using what's best, like, you know.
I know. Yeah.
Sorry. It sounds promotional, but. Anyways, Shimano boys come at me. They're going to be very angry.
Okay. Gravel racing. Next hot take. Gravel racing without categories means 90% of us are just paying for group rides. I mean, yeah. Even when there are categories, 98% of us are just paying for group rides.
Everyone beside the winner and those that are battling for the win. Yeah, that's what you're doing, really. Like, but it's paying for the experience. It's just like a concert. Like, this is akin to saying that, like, going to a concert, like, you know, it's, I could listen to the music in my car or do something else on my own. And like, yeah, you could, but it's the experience that you're going for. And that experience in and of itself is valuable. It's cool to be there on the day with everybody else.
Yeah. And ride with people that you wouldn't have ridden with otherwise, and ride in an area that you wouldn't have been to otherwise. Like, yeah, it's a group ride, but it's a cool experience.
Agreed.
Yep. All right. Hot take. In a race, when you ride by the photographers, it's a temporary 20% boost in your power output.
Not for me. I get super self-conscious. Is my number plate straight? Is my helmet crooked? I don't know.
You it's like see the photographers?
Yeah. If I see one, I totally run through those things and it's dumb and I shouldn't, you know, but that's if I see them. Yeah, for sure. Good point, Ivy. A lot of the time you don't even see them.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see them. Yeah.
But I see a lot of people ham it up for the camera. So maybe that is the case, you know? So
yeah,
I could see it. Not for me though.
Yeah. Couldn't be me. If I would see them, I would just be still like, cool. Hey man, I'm still just trying to not die here. So yeah, I can't do anything for you.
Let me live.
All right. Hot take. More protective gear is needed for cycling, and honorable mention, bike racing is inherently dangerous. So that's part of why we like it. So kind of two different perspectives here. It's dangerous. We need more protection, and that, it's inherently dangerous. And that's part of it. So what do you think?
I think cycling has a wide spectrum of people that view danger from different perspectives. I personally do agree that because bike racing is inherently dangerous, I'm subconsciously drawn to it because I'm drawn to risk. That's like my sort of like personality profile. Risky things make me feel alive, and they light up a lot of good chemicals in my body. And as a result, like I'm like an addict to it. I personally think that that's like, that's absolutely something that I've had. If I look back through my life, it's been like a pattern nonstop all throughout it, like risky sports and risky things I really like. So I do agree with that for me. I don't agree with that for everybody. In terms of more protective gear being needed for cycling though, yeah, like absolutely. It's pretty absurd when you think about like what we're doing. If we can get protective gear that allows the same mobility, and then also allows the same cooling. And then if you want to throw a cherry on top, allows the same aerodynamic benefit, that would be amazing. Those are really hard constraints to follow. But it does need more protective equipment, and we should normalize it better.
Yeah. And I don't think any of the athletes that, you know, XC racers don't wear full face helmets, not because they think they don't need it or don't want it. It's that they consciously make a decision that, like, this will, like, I have to decide if what's more important here, performance and cooling and comfort, or taking this risk. So I don't think anyone, you know, well, I could be wrong. That's a blanket statement. But I think most athletes in the sport really agree that, yeah, what we're doing is kind of insane and we should have more protective gear, but we make a choice to not to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think people make the choice to use less protective gear to make it more dangerous. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. Somebody should let me know in comments. So
there's definitely some outliers out there that are more addicted to risk than you are.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yikes. All right. Hot take: using a heavy bike with high resistance for most rides will make you faster on race day. So
this is so Rocky Balboa.
And I super disagree with this because I kind of experienced something like this when we would have race wheels with the team equipment, like in the team trailer. Tubular race wheels. And then on home would just be on like aluminum clinchers. And so I would get to like the first few races of the season and all of a sudden be on rocket ship wheels and forget how to steer. And
yeah,
you know,
totally.
So like it didn't make me faster on race day. It made me hesitant and uneasy on race day. So I disagree with this hot take. What do you think?
I disagree too. If your goal is training, then train with structure, and that's going to make you a whole lot faster. Training on like a heavier, slower bike. I mean, yes, in theory, if you're doing that, then you go to a lighter one, it will feel easier. So I understand this. Yes, there's a certain part where this is right, but nah, like overall, this is just a Rocky Balboa way to train. So it's popular on Instagram when you're like towing a car tire behind your bike, though. That gets a lot of views when you have like a reel of that. So I've seen that getting put around there, but why don't you just go hard?
Yeah.
Like, you know, just, I don't know. Yeah.
Okay. Next hot take. Taping the timing number on your handlebars is an absurd manner to be aero. It isn't helping anything.
It is helping.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes if it's a timing chip and they don't actually need to see the number, like gravel races do this a lot. You don't need to, there's no one at the, like not an official, like looking at numbers or bib numbers. It's just really a timing chip and there happens to be a number on your plate. I'll zip tie it or attach it to the head tube. And, it's not just for being aero. It's like, the flapping of a plate number is so annoying to me and so distracting. And I just like, I don't want to see it or think about it, you know?
Yeah. And I've even seen some plates, like they're bumping against your frame. And then by the end of the day, like they've like kind of worn a little spot into your clear coat or something. It's like, or they're just flapping around and annoying. I can't stand it. And it does make you slower. It is measured. The specialized wind tunnel looked into this. So, I mean, yeah, like it is there. I think there is a difference. And if somebody wants to do that, and if somebody doesn't want to do it, it's fine either way. But I wouldn't frown upon anybody for doing it otherwise. If it's a timing chip, I do like, event organizers are going to be upset at me for this, but like I've cut the timing chip out of a number plate before and then just like not even ran the, because sometimes you get like five number plates for a race and you're supposed to attach them everywhere. Like I cut the timing chip out and I put it in my jersey pocket or something, or I taped it to the bottom of my saddle once. And that's
nice.
And that way, like I didn't have to worry about it. I don't know. We should really figure out the whole like number thing. And I'm glad that less gravel races now are giving you numbers for jerseys. There's like, if you're a gravel race and you give me a number for your jersey, I'm not putting that number on, like flat out. Like that's one of the biggest annoyances of road races is numbers that you have to poke holes in your really expensive kit just to put it on, when really like it has a chip already. Like what's the point? Like, you know,
yeah,
it's super frustrating for me. So I can't stand giving numbers.
I have to plug TNR tape right now because I love it so much. Man, that stuff works really well. If you put it on a dry skin suit or jersey before you start warming up, man, that stuff works really well. And I haven't put holes in any of my kit since then.
It doesn't leave residue?
As long as you rip it off within like an hour of finishing the race, it doesn't leave anything. Folks will like leave it on for you know, throw the whole jersey in their laundry bin with a number still on it and then like whoops and try to like yank it off 4 or 5 days later before they throw it in the wash, and the adhesive has like really dried by then, and it then you might have some problems. But yeah, I'm a big fan. I love it.
I've used
and I don't 3M's. Need anyone's help to do it either. You know, and I don't have to like drape my jersey over my knees to like figure out what position. Like you can just put the tape on the number and then just like use like even the reflection of like your car window, just like see where to put it and just slap it on there. It's awesome.
Easy.
Big fan.
3M77 is a spray that I've used before on my numbers. And I know a lot of people say like you spray it on the number, let it tack up, then put it on. But most people end up when they try to use that, they get adhesive stuck into their kit. And it kind of ruins their kit, or it even causes like some sublimation to get pulled, like to fade and to like kind of lose its color. So it kind of like pulls the color quote off of your jersey in a way too.
Weird.
So anyways, I don't really like, I know Nate swore by 3M77, but I don't really like it. It doesn't do great stuff to my kit. I've tried magnets before to hold on numbers, and those worked really poorly because they would like pinch so tightly that the number wouldn't stretch like the jersey would stretch. So it would get to a point where they would move and they would pull off of the number or something. So, how about we never pin a number onto a jersey because it's 2023?
Yeah. We don't have to.
Great. We don't have to. Put people on the moon. So,
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Cool. I agree. All right. Hot take or hot idea. We need more off-road juniors teams and programs for young riders.
This is not a hot take. This is just a fact. And like, I think everybody agrees, right? It's amazing.
Too, specifically off-road. I feel like all of the riders that I know that ride successfully and happily as adults, like at an elite and professional level or not, just like that still ride, if they began as juniors, it was off-road stuff. Because I just feel like off-road riding just fosters so much like fun and so much more opportunity to develop, you know, soft skills in cycling, you know, not just like how fit and fast can you be. And when I see a lot of like junior programs that are road focused, man, it's really hard for, I think, kids to really for the focus of their purpose of riding a bike is how fit can I be? How hard can I pedal? Like that's not a lot of fun. It's not a lot of fun for adults sometimes, like especially kids. And so, yeah, I agree. I think more off-road junior teams is not a hot, not a controversial hot take. Like it's a good idea. Needs to happen.
Agreed. Yep. Agreed.
Yeah. All right. Hot take 2023 will be the first year with multiple American stage winners of the Tour de France since 2003. Making it one of only 3 times it has happened. In 86, it happened with Finney and LeMond, and in 87, it happened with Finney and Jeff Pierce.
Quite the
shout out to Jeff Pierce. He's a good guy.
Nice. I didn't, yeah, cool.
Super
I didn't
guy. Know you knew him. Yeah, we lived in Seattle together, and he and his then partner, like she and I trained together a lot, and he would come into the bar that I worked at, and I would make him cocktails. He's a super nice guy. Yeah.
That's awesome. How cool.
Yeah. He's super cool.
I agree with this. So we have, I think Sepp Kuss is doing it. I think Brandon McNulty's doing it. We have Nielsen Palace, and we also have Magnus Sheffield, I think, is doing it. Mateo Jorgensen is doing it. And we have Quinn Simmons. Man, I'm probably forgetting somebody there, but I think that's 6. If I can count with fingers, I might be counting wrong, but I think that's 6. Really good athletes that I think could win. Specifically, we have Mateo and we have Quinn and Sheffield that are likely going to be stage hunters, whereas the others are likely going to be racing for GC.
Do you think Sepp will be racing for GC?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. Yeah, yeah, he'll be. Oh, I mean, not for him, but to protect a GC rider, I should say, you know, so. Okay. The rest, though, and I think, you know, they'll all be working for somebody, but I also think that Sepp won't get cut loose to chase stage wins as readily as the others would. I wish he would.
It'd be so cool to see him, like, take a crack at a big mountain stage, and, man.
I think they've tried riding with him as a leader in, like, week-long stage races. I don't know if it was, like, Basque Country or Tour de Suisse or something like that, and I remember it not going well, but that's one race, you know, so... Mm-hmm. it would be cool to see, but at the same time, Seth does an incredible job delivering as he does. He's one of the rare riders that's able to like ride and pace. He's one of the last riders on the mountains for the main protected rider. He's one of the last domestiques, but instead of just blowing up and pulling off, what he usually does is he blows up and then he attaches to the back of the person that's like chasing them and is next across the line in the group. So like, that's super impressive. But yeah, I think we will get two stage winners. Part of that is hopeful. I could absolutely see a world where we don't, but I would love it. It'd be mm-hmm. great.
I agree.
Very excited for it.
Uh-oh. John, did you add this last hot take? I'm not prepared. Hot take. Yeah. Tour de France Unchained is the best thing to happen to cycling in the last 20 years. I'm so embarrassed that, A, I don't really know what this is. B, uh-huh. definitely haven't watched it. Like, brother, I'm just trying to keep it together. Like, I am not on Netflix right now. So, is it on Netflix? Where is it on?
It is. It's on Netflix. Yep. Yeah, it's on Netflix. It's like the Drive to Survive, this box-to-box productions. They made Drive to Survive, Breakpoint, Full Swing. They've made like these ones where they like go inside the behind the scenes with the athletes. They've made incredible series. And I think this one is not good, not that good in terms of just like a series on its own. But absolutely think it's a net positive for cycling, particularly if people can just get through the first like 2 to 3 episodes. It gets better, I found, after that. But
what's wrong with the first couple episodes?
I think it was produced by a French company. And I think that the decision was made that they should then dub the voices in and that we shouldn't just have subtitles that explain it. So I feel really detached from the athletes and the staff. And I would love to have more human connection. And what makes Drive to Survive, Breakpoint, and Full Swing, what makes those so good is there's these really strong characters and the entire thing is just focused on around the character development. And then like the backstory is how they're doing in the sport, really. But it's really just about like the individuals and getting to know them. And I know like a lot of people have said like, oh, this is great because they explain the sport a bit more, particularly in those first 2 to 3 episodes. And that will be helpful for people. But I would counter that with the fact that like cycling has never been more popular, at least here in the United States and even worldwide, than when Lance Armstrong was doing well. And it wasn't because Lance Armstrong was going around telling people like, this is a Peloton and this is an Echelon and this is how a Grand Tour works. It's because mm-hmm. Lance Armstrong was an absolute personality and character, regardless mm-hmm. of what he did on and off the bike. He was a character that was interesting. And as a mm-hmm. result, people loved to watch it. And I think that that's what brings people in. It's not explaining the sport so they can understand. People will understand things and they'll figure things out. They've understood Formula One now, and they've done that because they know that like Daniel Ricciardo, Yuki, Carlos Sainz, all these drivers, they're able to connect with them now in a way that they never knew, and they're interested in their personalities. So mm-hmm. I just wanted more strong personalities, you know,
yeah.
highlight them. But yeah. I'm very grateful it's there. I think it will help. But it's not the greatest thing to happen to cycling in the last 20 years.
Okay. What do you think is? Response. I'm going to say for me, it's normalizing eating candy on the bike has been the best thing to happen to cycling. Yeah.
E-bikes. Ooh, that's going to be a hot take, but that's my e-bikes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I think so too.
To cycling. Yep.
Yeah.
You know what? Opening up the door so much.
You know what? I really don't care that there are like maybe a few more brake bumps on the single track that there was before. Like,
oh yeah.
Because of e-bikes. I really just don't care anymore because like people that like weren't stoked about riding bikes and maybe had a physical barrier to doing so earlier, are now like able to and stoked to ride bikes. And like,
so cool.
It's not just about like, yeah, they might be physically able to like go on a flat bike path. And like now they have access to like really cool, unbelievable trails and like viewpoints and things that like would have been really not enjoyable for them prior. And I know people disagree with that. I just don't care anymore. I just love seeing like people stoked out there in a place where they couldn't go or weren't comfortable going otherwise. I love it.
100%. I agree, Ivy. Best thing to happen to bikes. Second to that is the one by drivetrain. So,
okay, but also candy.
Also candy. Yes.
Yeah. One by drivetrain. Super good. Wait, tubeless too. All so tubeless. Okay, that's it.
Tubeless is good.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, and subscribe. I'm sorry. It's over now. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, like and subscribe. Absolutely. Thanks, Ivy. This is fun.
Yeah, thanks, John.
If people have questions, where can they submit their questions to the podcast?
trainerroad.com/podcast. Or
awesome.
You don't have to wait for a podcast. You can DM me on Instagram at IVRDrain. You probably could with John, too.
That's a bold claim.
John, people do anyways. It never stops. It's not right.
Yeah. Follow Trainer Road on Instagram. Incredible, awesome stuff from Ivy and Sarah coming out all the time on there. Quick little bits where we dig into science or show you details about Trainer Road that you haven't used yet. Once again, if you're listening to this, rate the podcast. That's huge for us. It's so helpful. We would love that. Rate it on Spotify, share it with your friends, and sign up for Trainer Road if you want us to build even more cool features, get more coming out for you. It's a really exciting time for us here at Trainer Road. We're working on solving some really cool problems that are going to change training forever. So sign up now. Get your friends to sign up. We'll talk to you next time. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.